We've got the man who made the Hellcat. Sergio gives Luca the boot, and Mazda has a new Miata.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy, episode 257 for September 12th. Meet the man who made the Hellcat. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website. Gary Vasilash, how you doing?
Good, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I've had a crazy week, but we'll get into some of that.
Yeah, we'll get into it later, but I think we ought to begin the show today. 9/11's today. We ought to give a tribute to the people who allow us to drive cars freely and all those who gave up their lives.
So yeah.
I want to start on a downer, but I think we ought to acknowledge that.
Never forget that. A day that will live in infamy.
Yeah.
And we got Chris Pockert from Autoblog with us, too. Great having you back, Chris.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks. It's always a good time.
Yeah. And, of course, we got to tell everybody we got Russ Rudicelli, the VLE and head of SRT Engineering, and he's got the Hellcat in the studio with us here.
We do indeed, yes.
Russ, thanks for coming and joining us on After
Hours. I'm glad to be here. I'm excited to be here, quite honestly.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about this car, because I want to go back to the very beginning. What got you guys thinking about, we got to do this thing called the Hellcat with 707 horsepower? I'm sure that's not how the conversation started, but what made you guys think we got to have the ubermost pony car of all time?
Well, you know, we were looking at doing a refresh of the car, and it was that time in the corporation where we're really, really trying to ramp up and be competitive in every one of the markets. And when you look at this market, you know, the other guys from in town were up in the horsepower game, right? And so we kind of futured that out and then added a little more on top just to have a little bit of safety. So
a little?
You want to shoot high, right? And the Hellcat name kind of evolved. I think that's an interesting story. Internally, we name all our engines with a code name. And that motor was the Hellcat. Wasn't ever meant to be on the car initially, but it just kind of stuck, and it gained momentum, and the brand guys really loved it. And
it's a great name.
Yeah,
it's a fantastic name.
It really is.
Name.
It has a lot of it means a lot of things to a lot of different people, so it works really, really well.
Because to me, it harkens back to the old World War II airplane,
exactly.
fighter plane.
Yep. That's how you name all of your engines, isn't it?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After fighter planes.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. Yes. We might have to change that after the show now because the secret's out.
Warships are next.
So when you sat down and said, okay, we got to do a killer engine here, did you pick a horsepower number to begin with, or did the engine tell you what it could do?
No, there were a couple levels of that, but ultimately we settled on 700. That was our target, and then the engine guys kind of over-delivered a little bit, which is awesome, you know. And I think, quite honestly, when I talked to them, they're like, you know, Russ, we didn't want to just show up with 700. We really wanted to show everybody that it was, you know, we could do more than that if we
had. Yeah, because if you had come out with 700, everyone would have said, they just rounded up. It's
exactly.
Probably 698 or whatever.
Yep. You're right, and so that was the feeling, and that's kind of how we got there. And I'm really proud of that team because that development, very, you know, very exciting car to work on, but very challenging from an engineering point of view. A lot goes into that running a 707 horsepower machine around the road.
So you're getting that out of a 6.2 liter engine and you're supercharging it.
Correct.
So tell us about the supercharger. You guys don't ordinarily go down that road.
No, you know, that was new to us. This is our first foray into supercharging. When we started out in the car, we looked a little bit at turbocharging, but supercharging, first of all, the throttle response is great. We also had a lot of feedback from our customers about, you know, there's other cars out there with superchargers. How come you guys don't want have one in the market? So that kind of pushed us in that direction, and what you see here is the result of that. So It's a twin screw supercharger, and we're running about 11.6 PSI boosted. It flows a ton of air. It flows 30,000 liters of air a minute. You can, we did this little calculation. It'll clean. In a minute. It'll suck the air out of your office at Chrysler. You know, so moving tons of air, and that made us do a lot of unique things to the car to get that much air into the car and working. You know, one of the unique things is up at the front in the headlight there. That's a patented little thing. That opening in the inside lamp next to the SRT badge actually flows air right into the air box.
So it's still a headlamp.
The outside circle of it is
a daytime running light.
Correct.
Right.
Lights up. But you know, that was a perfect place to get nice, cool, clean air, and it feeds right into the airbags and then up into the supercharger.
It looks fantastic. It looks really cool.
Yeah,
that air intake.
That was one of those fun little things we got to do.
That's a little racer trick, right?
Well, it is, right? That comes back from, you know, racing at Salt Flats and stuff. Pull the headlamp out on one side and feed it right into the induction system.
So that supercharger has to require a serious amount of power to get moving, right? I mean, you guys have to have some fun calculations associated with that as well.
Yeah, I remember the guys told me it's around 70 horsepower to run the thing at fully rated power on the engine. So there's really more happening before it gets to the wheel.
So it's really 777 horsepower, right?
I'm not going to quote anything, but yes, that is correct. There's a lot more. You got to drive that thing. So yeah, it's a neat design, very compact. There's two actual coolers on either side of the supercharger. So as the air flows in, it goes over those intercoolers and cools the charge in. There's actually its own standalone water system to cool that. So separate from the engine cooling system, there's a water circuit, a giant electric pump. It'll flow 11 gallons a minute at full power.
Geez.
And, the whole idea is to keep the car at rated power and not have to derate and pull it back. Everybody, all of us in building cars, have a lot of safety features in place. So if you get in a problem with too much heat or overheating things, we'll pull power out. And so we wanted to avoid that, as much as possible. So when we did initial benchmarking, we found a lot of our customers or our competition had struggled with that. You know, we'd go out at racetracks and things. And so we really sized the system to avoid that.
How did you get to 700 plus horsepower? I mean, what was the key enabler, or what were some of the hurdles? Because, you look at a Z06 Corvette, it's quote-unquote only 650. And I'm sure a bunch of them, other competitors of yours, that is, are scratching their head, like, how did they get that much?
Well, we have engine wizards. I'm not one of them, but we have engine wizards. I think certainly, the efficiency of the supercharger. And then the bottom end is very robust. It's a unique block, but it's a cast iron block. Forged crank, forged pistons, forged rods. So I think all that stuff together and a lot of boost pressure is where it comes from.
Yeah, you mentioned the crankshaft, and you guys put out a line about this, which I think is very interesting. The crank is so well engineered it can withstand the firing pressures of 110 bar, which is 1,595 PSI, the equivalent of five family sedans standing on each piston every two revolutions.
Yeah, it's working really, really, really hard. It's the engine is it's got all the latest and greatest hot rod tricks in it, and we make the power, and it's reliable power. That's the other great thing.
So the word is that the actual builds are coming in above 707 horsepower.
I don't know anything about it.
I'm sure you don't.
I will say one thing that's interesting. So that engine's built at the Saltillo assembly plant, where you build all the Hemi engines at the engine plant. Excuse me, and. So it goes down the same line in most cases, spurs off and back on. But each one of the Hellcat engines, unique to them, is a dyno run-in. They get 42 minutes on a dyno and run it power.
In fact, I heard you guys had to get new dynos to be able to test this thing.
We did over at CTC. We had to upgrade our dynos. We had to upgrade the air handling that we could do. We changed a lot of our testing. You know, this thing breaks into Viper's area top speeds, right? So we had to think about things differently. You know, we can't do top speed runs that high at Chelsea, so we had to go other places to get to do our top speed runs, our VMAX runs.
Yeah. So you mentioned Viper, and that brings to mind, was there any sort of corporate politicking going on that we have to keep the Vipers, the Halo? Was there any gnashing of teeth about putting this much power in this car?
So I'm the guy that does both those cars, and no, there really wasn't. Maybe naively, I was surprised at how much banter there was back and forth on the ultimate horsepower number. They're really different cars with two very different briefs or set of requirements. The Viper is 1,000 pounds lighter, really designed to do a different thing. But again, naive on my part, but I didn't think it would be such a big deal that the ultimate number was higher than than the Viper, and that would be a big deal.
So you brought a green car in here,
which
is awesome. And as you know, we do a lot of video production work using a green screen. And I don't know how they did it, but my guys here figured out how we can put all the different Viper, because you were talking about it.
Sorry.
All the different Challenger colors that are offered on this car. So let's go through it. Chip, why don't we get to that?
Well, it's got to be Gary.
Okay. Oh, Gary's driving it all.
Gary has the power.
All right.
Tell me when we're ready. Oh, we're ready already.
Ooh, we got a white car.
It's the Billet Silver Metallic car. Or it should be. Or it's
that looks whitish.
It looks like the bright white car. Looks like we may have missed the Billet Silver. There's the bright white. And here we're going for the Granite Crystal car. Ivory white. And now we're at Jazz Blue.
That looks like it could be cool. I haven't seen that one.
So for all of you out there, we're not just using variations on white here. That they are actually.
How does this happen?
So then we're at this is
oh black.
This is Phantom Black.
Oh, that's a mean looking car.
It's almost not even here. And then we'll be shortly going to another black. And we're at Pitch Black. Back to the sublime green that we've had here. And last but not least, this is a pun, Torred. All the colors of... So how did you guys... I mean, did you guys pick the colors at SRT or did some people in the design studio?
That's really design studio driven. And what the market's asking for. You know, the Challengers typically get a little more exciting on the color palette than some other places. And the customers, I would say order more. We had a little discussion before. They're not, black, white, and silver customers for the most part. I think this is the most dramatic palette we have and use.
So what's your favorite color?
It didn't start out this way, but it's the green.
Yeah.
Initially, I wasn't a big fan of it, but, there's a little bit of pearl in the color, and it's just very exciting out on the street.
It looks like it would lend itself well to some billboard graphics and some historic nods to Mopar's past?
Well, yeah. If you remember the Sam Posey Trans Am car, it was kind of that color with the big 7.7 on the side. Yeah.
Hey, tell us about the hood on this car, because I haven't seen this kind of hood, I don't think, with the air. You've got the big air intake in the center, and then you've got air extractors flanking that.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up. The aero on this car was very important. We talked about getting air into the car. Also, moving it around the car is very important. So the air extractors on the top of the hood are not only to get air out from underneath the engine compartment, but it kind of smooths out the flow inside the engine compartment, so it helps draw air in. Additionally, a lot of work was done on aero balance. So none of the SRT products are speed limited electronically. They're all... Our top speed is determined by the amount of power available and the drag on the car, which is a great thing, but you also have to keep aero balance so the car's stable at really, really high speed. So the splitter on the lower edge of the front fascia is unique only to the Hellcat. You can see that it steps way out farther than the base cars. Additionally, the rear spoiler in the back is unique to the Hellcat, and it's 10 millimeters taller than any of the other cars. Mm-hmm. And that's really so you have some downforce in the back of the car at the top speed.
So everything you put on that car is functional. It's not cosmetic. It works.
That's a great point. We have kind of pillars we talk about on SRT, and one of them is functional exterior. So there's no fake intakes or grooves or it's all for function. The grill is unique on the Hellcat. That lower grill actually is removable with about, I think it's 4 or 6 screws. So, you know, if you're taking the car to the track and you're out, you know, in Arizona, you can get a little bit more airflow. We thought that would be a nice feature for our customers.
No, that is cool.
We find a lot of our customers, take the cars to track days. So, in fact, that's one of our design briefs is that the car's got to be able to run 20 minutes. We have some special tracks we use out west that I won't tell you where they are, but they have to run a 20-minute track cycle without derating and or backing off on power.
So let's go back to the hood a minute, because
sure.
I haven't
Sorry.
Seen this before. Is this going to be a later addition, or you guys just had...
No, that hood's on all the Hellcats.
It is?
Yeah, yeah. The base SRT has the center scoop, but the Hellcat gets the extractors on each side. Hmm. This is probably the first car you've seen with the flat black hood, but the...
That's true, right. Know,
so it's optional with a flat black and
correct.
The body color is,
mm-hmm.
but they all have that hood.
All the Hellcats do,
right.
Yes. Yep.
So I guess we should probably mention that there is another Challenger SRT that has a mere 485 horsepower.
Yeah, lightweight in the group.
So I've got to ask you. So, okay, I happened to be on the drive program for this car, and we were out at Portland International mm-hmm. Raceway.
Yep.
And... Now, when you guys were thinking about this car, were you thinking about going in a straight line really fast, or are you thinking about it also going on a road course rather quickly?
So both. That's really important to us at SRT that, you know, you can go out, take your car out on the track, a road course, and be comfortable and have fun. You know, it's not a narrow focus track car by any means, but you would never be embarrassed going out on the track. And then the drag racing stuff came along kind of for the ride. The burnout thing with this car is just like taking on a life of its own. I didn't expect that, but the videos and the stuff online with people doing burnouts and tire smoke. My tire budget's kind of a mess this year.
I was going to say those are expensive burnouts.
Yes, they are. They are.
I was fortunate enough to drive one of these this week with the 8-speed automatic in it. And one of the things that really impressed me about it was the low speed drivability. I don't want to name any names, but a certain competitor with the blue oval on the front, the low speed drivability of that range topping car is not that great.
Okay.
It just feels kind of unhappy. Like you're going to go off the side of the road any minute just because there's so much power at your disposal and it's hard to meter it out. This car was very simple to do that, and I've got to imagine there's a lot of tricks in making that happen.
Well, yeah, a lot of work was done on drivability. We didn't want this thing to scare anybody. In fact, we did some development drives this winter in the snow, and I've driven a manual Hellcat in the snow, and you can do it. It's not a big deal, right? I mean, you can still defy physics if you mash your foot to the ground, or you'll never defy physics. And if you mash your foot to the ground, it'll come around on you. But a lot of it was drivability and not being this, you know, hair trigger kind of thing. And it sounds like that's what you're noticing.
Mm-hmm. And then the other question I had is, you've got two keys for this car. You've got the black pill and the red pill, which you
yes.
got to take.
In fact, we've got them right
yeah.
here
oh,
in front
excellent.
Of me right now. Yeah.
So that's it's a neat concept, but the black pill, which is the less powerful spec, is still what, 500 horsepower?
500 horsepower.
So that's not
yeah.
really like something you're going to want to give to your teenage son or daughter or a valet. I mean, what's the...
So there's a couple of things, and we've...
Well,
had
describe what the keys or the fobs do.
Yeah, so the black key is, you get two keys with the car, actually three keys, two black and one red, and the red one's the only one that unleashes the 707 horsepower. And the thought is the owner is probably going to want to have that one, and then, you know... You give it to your friend, maybe you only give him the black key. So it's a little bit of, you know, I guess, guy thing going on there. But we have a really neat feature that we started on this product called valet mode. And so you can go in on the screen on the center, hit valet mode, and it'll ask you for a code. It's just 4-digit. You make it up as you go. You can, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. And that cuts back on the power. So it won't launch in first gear. It only revs to 4,000 RPMs. Paddle shifters don't work. You can't disable any of the electronic stability. And the idea there is if you give it to a guy changing your oil, if you don't change your own oil, or you drop it off at a restaurant, you feel comfortable leaving the car. And then when you come back, just jump back in, hit 1, 2, 3, 4, and you're back to whichever key you're carrying, the 707 or the 500. So that's really where the big difference is. Yeah, because some people have said 700 to 500, Russ. You know, it's a 100 horsepower car.
That's really good.
Well, hey, we've got quite a few questions
good.
Coming in from the audience, but we're going to take a quick commercial break and come back and get to those because as many questions as we've asked you, there's a whole lot more to ask you there, Russ.
Great. Looking forward to it.
Cool. We'll be back in just a moment here.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there, running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Okay, we got a whole bunch of questions here coming in from the audience. Wright Knight says, with the new management at Ferrari, why not put this baby in the 458 Italia?
I don't think you'll ever see this engine in a Ferrari.
Dr. Botox wants to know, what tricks will the aftermarket do for those who feel 707 horsepower is not enough?
Yeah, that's my guess is that they're... People overspin the supercharger. I mean, that's the quickest way to power is more boost.
Didn't you guys lock somehow the electronic control unit so you can't, like, just chip this car?
Yeah, that's true. We have a lot of stuff in place, but you can mechanically still do that. And that's my guess is the first place they'll go. To your point, I mean, we have rabid fans that drive SRTs, and no matter what we give them, they want more.
And that'll be a warranty issue then, won't it?
Yes, it will. Yeah.
It's remarkable that you can get 707 horsepower. It's a standard warranty, the same as the rest
exactly.
of
the... Exactly. Yeah,
that's amazing.
That's one of the things we're really proud of. Same durability and warranty that you'd, you know, on any of our products, but 707 horsepower.
JM1NB wants to know, what changes to the chassis, interior, or structure did you do to accommodate this kind of power?
Well, the chassis quite a bit. The structure was pretty good on the car. The chassis let's go back a little bit. We put wider wheels on the car, so it's got 9.5 by 20 inch wheels. They're forged, and we worked on really pulling a bunch of weight out of them.
Are those magnesium?
No, they're aluminum.
Okay.
The finish kind of has a bit of that look.
It does.
To get wider tires on it, we actually hemmed the rear wheel wells. They weren't hemmed in the past and kicked up the flanges in the front. And then because of the top speed we have, we upgraded the brakes. So up front, we've got a 15.4-inch rotor. That's the biggest rotor we've ever put on a car. And it's a two-piece system. So the center hub is aluminum to save some weight. And then the outer wear surface is actually a floating rotor that the Brembo guys helped us with. And then it's got a 6-piston caliper in the front and then the standard SRT brakes in the back. So that's kind of, we also upgraded the springs, the shocks. We upgraded the sway bars. So that's kind of the big chassis stuff.
Anything to the trans?
Yeah, so the 8-speed's new in this car. And for the Hellcat, it's actually a high-output version of it. So the gears are a little bit wider in this. Transmission's actually longer. And the clutch packs were upgraded and improvements to the friction material.
You know, really, it's interesting to know because Chris mentioned sort of in passing that it was an automatic transmission.
Yep.
You can get a manual on this as well.
You can. And, we talked about heat management. This is the first manual transmission we've put in the car with its own cooling system. We got through a duty cycle where we were running the transmissions hotter than we wanted to, the manual. So there's a cooling circuit, and the transmission actually has a small pump that drives the fluid through.
That's kind of cool, you know, when you see Porsche and Ferrari abandoning manuals. It's kind of cool that you guys have stuck with it.
Yeah, some of us still like those manuals.
Let's see here. VRM Chris wants to know, might And this is a question I wanted to ask earlier, actually, okay. So I'm glad he asked it. Might the Hellcat engine be available on the Jeep Grand Cherokee SRT?
I will not discuss future products.
All right.
Yeah, we also have Badnik L wants to know if it's going in the Viper.
I will not discuss future products.
I've heard that it doesn't fit in the Viper because it's too wide.
Yeah, there's issues with getting any Hemi into the into the Viper because
of
how narrow it is.
But you're putting it in the Charger.
We are. Yep, we announced that at Dream Cruise. Very exciting product, and it's interesting. Bigger car, but a little bit better aerodynamically. So the top speed's actually going to be higher on the Charger than it is on the Charger.
Because this one here is 199, I think, and the Charger is what, 204?
204, yep.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about adding an extra set of doors, but it seems like a much more rational decision to have a 707-horsepower sedan as opposed to a big coupe.
You got to love it. Push to Start wants to know, is SRT now fully under Dodge?
Yeah, that was a change we made when, joining up with Fiat, the official joining of the companies, and making the transition for Dodge to be the performance brand, we decided to roll Dodge in, SRT in. So we'll still be the top of the performance lineup.
But only for the Dodge brand.
That's what it looks like. We'll continue with the... I shouldn't say that because we're going to continue with the Grand Cherokee, and we'll see. We're kind of a little skunk works, and we'll help out anybody in the group that wants to go fast.
It's cool. I love when companies have skunk works. I really do. And in fact, going back to VRM, Chris, he's asking about a Dart SRT.
I'm not going to
talk about future product. That's good. That's good.
I think
good
that
hear.
Was in the product plan that they rolled out, that 7-year product plan.
Oh, yeah. So see, Sergio already gave it away. At least according to Chris Bacher.
You know what? He's not talking.
That's going to be called the Meerkat.
Very
that's
good,
Chris. Come on.
Yeah.
But I talked to Jeff Gale about this car, who's exterior designer, and he was talking about the 1971 car being the inspiration for this. Could you talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, that's a great story. The design office team brought in a 71 and parked it in the studio. And, worked on, just sat around, sketched surfaces, major kind of lines. And you'll see that on the interior of the car when you look at it. The console really harkens back to that, where it's kind of biased toward the driver. And the same with the instrument panel. It was more cockpit or driver based. They actually had the clay modelers clay up the 71 panel first, start with that, and then start to morph from
no
there.
No kidding. Oh, just cool. So they got the feel.
Exactly.
Wow. How interesting.
Yeah. And then that kind of rolled in some of the tail lamp assemblies have a similar look to the 71 and some of the front end stuff. But yeah.
How
wild. That's where a lot of inspiration was drawn from.
We get a number of phone calls here, and we've got one in. And Ben, let's bring in that phone call.
Yes, my name is Clem Zarovsky from Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question is regarding to these high-performance cars. I'm old enough to remember back in the 60s when you couldn't insure one of these high-performance cars. The insurance company wouldn't insure them. Do you see this coming back nowadays with all these 600-700-horsepower cars? Thank you.
Boy, I don't have a good answer for that. I haven't got any feedback from anybody. Of course, this car is just hitting the market. But you're right; insurance is part of anybody's bill on these cars. It's a very narrow portion of the market anymore. So I don't think it's going to be as big a deal as it was, back in the 70s when there was a lot of pressure from the insurance companies to push that out.
I'm sure the premiums are fun, but there's risk tables out there for just about everything now. So. Yep. You can get it.
Gearhead wants to know, does the red key void the warranty like others do?
Absolutely not.
Of course.
That's a good point. Yeah. Nope.
And Rick wants to know, what's the weight of the Viper motor versus the Hellcat? Do you know?
I do not. I think with the supercharger and everything, this motor is slightly heavier than the V10 aluminum Viper motor.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if I can read this. It's at Albuak or Ajbuak. I'm butchering the name. Via Twitter came in. He wants to know, how much dyno time did the Hellcat engine have during development? Was it more than a typical engine program?
It was more than... We did more on everything. You know, we talked about having new dynos for the Hellcat just to handle the power and the air handling. I don't know the percentages on the dyno time, but it was certainly more than we've done on a Hemi in a long, long time. I know on the aerodynamics side, we spent, the guys added up, we measure this stuff at Chrysler, right? How long the fan's running in the wind tunnel, and we had 35% more time on the car than we did the last generation car. And that goes for a lot of stuff. A lot of the testing was upgraded because this motor is and this car is so radical.
Well, you're pushing everything, aero and engine to the max here.
Absolutely. Brakes, exhaust systems, fuel handling system. We have a half-inch fuel line on this car.
That blows my mind.
I know. We couldn't get enough fuel up front.
So that begs the question, what's the mileage on this car? Because the EPA doesn't...
Yeah, we haven't announced the mileage yet. We're really close, but we're trying to get into 20, the low, you know, around 20.
The lesser SRT is 15 city and 25 highway, so...
Yeah. So we'll have that. I probably even shouldn't have told you that number, but we'll have that in a couple of days with the EPA.
Well, speaking of numbers, I mean, I find it to be fascinating. You were talking about all the development that you did and all the extras that you did, and you went through all of the features on this vehicle and the extra cooling and all the aero and so on and so forth. And the car is $60,000. I mean, how were you able to do that?
Really good engineering. No, you know, it's a combination, right? I only handle the engineering side. The marketing guys, of course, set the pricing on the car. But, you know, $60,000 is a lot of money. But at that performance level, I really think
it's not a lot of money for that
deal.
Performance level. I agree totally. Crank It wants to know, would Boa and Luke Duke finally be able to outrun the police for once and for all?
This might do it. This one might do it for him.
And Ray Salas wants to know, and he wrote in via Facebook, so, you know, just so everybody knows, you can Twitter us, you can Facebook us too. Why is the Hellcat used the 6.2 and not the 392 6.4 liter?
Yeah, there was some sizing between the supercharger and the efficiency of the engine that pushed us into the 6.2. I'm not the perfect guy to talk about that, but there was a lot of discussion on how to do that. And then, of course, the loads. You know, you talked a little bit about stacking all those houses on top of pistons. You know, that was the when we did the modeling of the motor. That's where it landed.
Okay, they're telling me we got another phone call. Ben, let's bring that in.
Hi, this is Jonathan out in Old Spanish,
right,
Jersey.
Jonathan.
I was curious, the Hellcat versus the naturally aspirated V10 and the Viper, what's the weight differential? Can you possibly tell us what each of these engines weigh? Great car. Looks like having a lot of fun, and I know...
Yeah, thanks. I don't know the exact number. I believe that... I wish I had the numbers in front of me, but I think that the Hellcat with the cast iron block and the supercharger on it is like 110 or 15 pounds heavier than the V10 Viper, which is an all-aluminum engine.
Let's see, and this might be the last question then, too. Chuck Grenchy wants to know, do you think this is going to escalate the horsepower war, or do you think the 707 will be king of the hill for a while?
Well, I think it'll be king of the hill for a while, but, you know, we, like, I think a lot of the other folks in this town thrive on competition. So I don't think this is the end by any means.
Well, I can tell you are going to have it for a little while.
Okay, fair enough.
I got a chance to talk to Mark Royce at the Dream Cruise, and he praised the car, praised you guys. He said, you know, you're only going to make us better, but they've definitely got you in their crosshairs.
That's okay. We like that. We like that. We love the competition.
Well, Russ Rudicelli, thanks so much for coming on and bringing your baby here.
Yeah, this is really great.
This is really cool, man.
Good. I'm really proud of this car. What the team did, it's really an amazing piece, and I'm just so proud to be able to be here and represent it. Thank you.
Cool. Thanks so much. Been a real pleasure having you here. So, pretty cool car. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
Like Gary, I got to drive it at the Portland International Raceway, and what a blast.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing is, when you get out on the road course, though, is you have to feed in the power judiciously, because it's so easy just to get the rear wheel spinning and the rear end to kick out.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it forced a level of finesse. When you get to the straights, no problem, just push it down all the way and it goes. But I found this thing to be a blast to drive on a road course.
Yeah, it was the thing that struck me was that, you know, you can sort of think of Mustangs being on a road course. You can think of maybe sort of a Camaro on a road course. But I thought, gee, this seems so unusual for a car that I was used to seeing going up and down Telegraph really fast, you know, straight line.
Well, it's like back in the old Trans Am days or something. Yeah. You know, you've got these big boxy forms that are moving around and... It's clearly a bigger car than something like a Mustang, but it does have that certain traditional muscle car.
Well, you know, in fact, they made that point at the intro. They said, don't really call it a pony car, even though I did earlier in the show. They're saying it's really a muscle car. Yeah. It's bigger than the old pony cars.
It's got a hell of a muscle, too, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. So what else? Chris, this week you were out looking at the new Mazda Miata, or can I even call it Miata, or is it just MX-5?
No, you know, it depends on what part of the world you're in. But here in the U.S., it's MX-5 Miata, and, you know, I think they tried to just get us to call it MX-5 for a few years, and they gave up on that because everybody knows it's the Miata. So much more evocative.
Once you've established a name in the public's mind, don't try to change it.
Yeah. Alphanumerics, don't get me started. So.
Yeah, right.
But, we saw the new ND, the fourth-generation car. And it's coming out in 2016. It'll probably be here, I'm guessing, in the, you know, early summer of next year.
And you're an MX-5 owner.
I am. I own a second-generation car. I'm a big fan of the entire franchise. I celebrate the entire catalog. and it's great to see that philosophically they seem to have honed in on what makes this car special.
So you like it?
I do. It's something that I don't think everybody is going to like at first glance. You know, people that are used to this car, they're used to the approachable sort of cartoony friendly looks. And this car looks a lot...
Smiling face.
This car looks a lot meaner. It sits lower. It's smaller. That's the interesting thing. Although they haven't released official specifications on just about anything. Lengthwise, it's actually apparently about 2 inches shorter than the original Miata. I mean, that's mind-blowing to me.
No kidding.
And it is, you see it on the road, and it's compact. And yet they've kept the interior space about the same. The passenger cell has moved back a little bit. The hood is really low. We asked about how they were able to achieve that in light of pedestrian crash regulations. And without getting into too much detail, there's some sort of mechanical component to that. So I'm betting on little charges.
Pop-up hood.
Pop the hood.
Throw people over.
And when you start to do that sort of thing, you get, well, isn't that going to be really heavy? But they've done all this, and they're claiming that they've taken 100 kilos out of the car. So
that's a lot.
That's, especially in a car that light, that's 220 pounds. And that's an extra person. And they've done it all the way through the entire car. You know, that gram by gram strategy that we've heard GM talk about was really something that they've
Mazda,
done on this.
I think Mazda actually was the one that went after this first. And,
they even went to, the CX-5, they went to smaller bolt head sizes
to
save weight.
But it's interesting, you know, you gotta say to these guys, I mean, about Mazda, is that while they're taking weight out, they're not making something that seems...
Chintzy.
Exactly right. It's just good, solid engineering that they're looking at everything. And so, you know, needless to say that this new car is making extensive use of aluminum.
Where have we heard that story before?
You got the hood, the trunk lid, the front fenders, you know, the bumper beam reinforcements, all aluminum. So, you know, this contributing to taking the weight out.
Well, and it even goes beyond that, just to the little things we're talking about. It's gone back to four lug wheels. Because they didn't need five.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone to a single exhaust outlet because any more would have just added weight. It might have looked a little bit cooler, but that's sort of debatable too. This is a purist's car. And basically the way it sounds is it seems like the car is going to weigh about 2,200, 2,300 pounds.
Yowza, and that's damn good these days.
So think about this. The Alfa Romeo 4C is about 2,400, 2,450. It's carbon tub car, you know, and it's got nothing inside of it. I mean, it's got, you know, prison lunch tray interior, right? I mean, all the plastics in it are just ghastly.
I might steal that line, by the way.
There's very little refinement in that car. And it's got a tiny little motor. It's got a 1.4. Now, we don't know what the engine is in this Miata. We think it's probably a naturally aspirated 2-liter and maybe a 1.5 in some markets. But that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of these lightweight, minimalist cars, and it looks like, you know, it's all lining up to being a great driving experience.
Though I got to tell you, the people here were, I was traveling, so I didn't get to see the reveal, but my people here were just pulling their hair out because you only saw the side of the car.
Yeah.
They never showed the front end, they never showed the rear end, they never showed the interior. All they showed was the side of the car.
Yeah, that's true. So what they did was they had this big, bombastic sort of presentation that they live streamed on the internet with Duran Duran. And, I mean, it was cool to have the Duran Duran show, but really, you know, they rolled out the car ahead of time, and then they said, here's Duran Duran. And you're right, you only really got to see the one side of the car. And I just wanted to scream and say, just give me quiet and more time with this vehicle.
Believe me, everybody on the video side were screaming at the screen.
Absolutely. And so in subsequent days, we were able to get more time with the car. I was able to sit inside of it. And one of the big areas of opportunities with this car is the interior in the current car. The NC generation, I mean, you know, the touch points are, you know, the key stuff, the gear shift, you know, the snick-snick and the wheel, they're the right size and the right location and all that. But the rest of the interior could probably use a rethink. And it seems to have gotten that. The materials are significantly better. There's technologies, even things that are basic these days. You can't get Bluetooth streaming audio in the current car, which, I mean, it's a minor little thing, but it is an annoyance if you're looking at buying the current car. All that stuff is in there. There's navigation. You couldn't get navigation before. And so they're going to have a lot of these things, a lot of these available features, and still lighter weight.
Does Mazda need this car?
Yeah, they do, I think. It's the best-known Mazda of all time,
but
I think. But seriously, more than the RX-7.
But, you know, it's interesting. If you look at the sales numbers for the car, they had their best sales year in 1990, mm-hmm. when they sold 39,850. Last year, they sold a grand total of 6,334.
And that's here in the States?
In the States.
Right.
Right.
So globally, between all four generations, they're at about 930,000, making it the most popular roadster of all time. Now, granted, that is a small, you know, that's small potatoes, those numbers. But you're looking at a car that's pretty much the moral center of the brand.
Yeah. Hey, we got more cars and a whole lot more things to talk about in just a minute, but we're going to take another break here for another commercial sponsor message.
Nice. Not nice.
The new Elantra from Hyundai. Nice.
You already know that you can listen to AutoLine's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to AutoLine.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play, just like you would on your computer.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from AutoLine's top-notch insider information with AutoLine on the go. Really want to thank our good friends at Hyundai for making that ad possible. And
speaking of Hyundai and ads, we should mention that, you know, there was a lot of changes this week in terms of executives and people changing at companies. And Jeff Bridges is no longer going to be the voice of Hyundai commercials. Sorry,
one of those car companies.
Yeah,
right.
Paul Rudd. Yeah. For the kids.
But I thought the big one was Luca di Montezemolo being booted out at Ferrari. That was a shocker to me. And
with a really big golden parachute.
What did he get? 24 million euros?
35.
Oh, 35 million euros. Yeah. Well, that's still not as much as their F1.
Yeah, and Ferrari reported today its first half revenue is up, or 14.5%, net profit up 9.8%. So he's leaving on an up note, huh?
I first met Luca in 1979 when Fiat, they had a big blowout in Las Vegas to introduce the Fiat Ritmo. I think it was called the Strada in Europe. And Johnny Agnelli was in, and Luca was available. And I got to sit down and talk with the guy. Remember, he ran the Ferrari F1 team when Niki Lauda won the championships. I mean, this guy's been bleeding Ferrari red since, you know, he got out of school. And he was a very charming guy, even way back then. You know, now he's practically an ambassador level kind of a diplomat.
Well, he's royalty, right? I mean, I think he's actually somehow royalty, right? Isn't that?
Is that right?
I think so.
No kidding. So I'm shocked to see him fired.
So do you think this is because he wanted to keep the number of Ferraris low?
Yes.
And Sergio said for our 7-year plan or whatever plan that was, that
volume.
We need more Ferraris and we need more profit margin.
I think you're right, Gary. I don't think, you know, because a lot of people are saying, oh, the Formula One team is doing so badly. And that's, I don't believe that for a second. I think it's exactly what you were talking about. You know, Luca wanted to keep it at $7,000 a year. Sergio's already talked about, hey, there's a capability of doing $10,000 a year. And, you know, it's a very delicate balance. If you build one too many, you piss off every Ferrari owner because now you're starting to degrade the value of it. You build one too few and you have everybody pissed off that they can't get one. But I would say with China coming on like it is, with Russia, you know, all the oligarchs over there buying Ferraris, with the Middle East and other emerging markets opening up, I think you can build and sell a lot more Ferraris.
It's really about valet stand density, right? I mean, you don't want to be one of six Californias at a given restaurant.
Right. So you don't want to increase your sales in Europe. You don't want to increase your sales in the United States. But there are a lot of other opening markets that you can sell Ferraris in that I do not think would devalue the value of the brand.
So Sergio's right. Luca is wrong?
From a pure business standpoint, I would go with Sergio on this one. I actually would.
Chris?
I mean, at least in the short term, I think he's probably right. You know, the volume is, you know, these emerging markets will support more volume. The question is over the long term, if they're devaluing the brand too much, you know, if they end up doing further line extensions or they've got all the marketing, you know, they put their name on absolutely everything. And they make tons of money on that. And I mean, I understand the temptation there, but at some point, I think you got to kind of seal that off.
Well, they're opening Ferrari World, so I mean, it's
another one. Yeah,
yeah. So it's like, exclusivity sort of goes out the window with things like that, doesn't it?
I think there were other arguments. You know, Sergio wants to put Ferrari engines in Maseratis. Chrysler Automotive News broke this story, is actually doing blocks, you know, casting and machining blocks that are going to Maserati. I think Ferrari too. And I'm sure there was a big argument inside. And my guess is Sergio just said, you know, I don't argue about this stuff. Let's get somebody in here who's not going to push back.
So this is Sergio, at least for the moment, taking more responsibilities on. Like he's already got a million different hats and the one sweater. And the question is how long is he going to be, you know, in this position? And is he setting up as, you know, a plan of succession for him after that? Because he
told the board he has a list of successors. So.
Okay.
Who's on that list, you know, remains to be seen. But
yeah, I say Richard Palmer. That's my guess right now.
You think?
The finance guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how far out do you see that being? I mean,
Sergio's 60 years old, 61. I see him being around to about 65-ish. Reed Bigland is another guy I'd keep my eye on. He's
doing real well.
He's doing, yeah. And, you know,
how he's going to do with his new job, that's going to be the big question. He may be sacrificial in that regard.
That's right, because with Sergio is you hit your numbers, you're golden. You don't hit your numbers, you're gone. It's just that easy. Hey, speaking of changes, too, we lost somebody that this week who was near and dear to my heart, Jim Harbour.
Yeah.
The manufacturing guy, the manufacturing guru, who I learned so much from, and a guy who really changed this industry from a manufacturing standpoint.
Yeah, when the annual Harbour report, when he was measuring the productivity of manufacturing plants and how well they did in each and every department, and I think that probably was an impetus to when you started the Quick Die Change Challenge, wasn't it?
Jim Harbour was actually the guy who planted that seed in my mind.
So this is John's early career.
Yeah, my Prince career.
When he and I were both taller.
and younger.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I learned a ton from Harbour, and he was actually a mentor in my career. He helped me strategize a career path that, really worked.
Mm-hmm.
And but Jim's big contribution was I think he was a finance guy. He actually started in finance and decided to go over to manufacturing. The only executive I've ever met in my life who went from finance to manufacturing. And then he developed great operational insight. And he would literally approach a manufacturing operation as a financial analyst would. Not just counting, you know, pennies here and there, but taking that kind of a mindset to it. And I think that's why he had such great insight, because I've never met anybody in manufacturing that started in finance.
Right. And the Harbor Report was to the manufacturing community what the J.D. Power survey is to the people on the product side. I mean, there's no question about that. And his son, Ron, continues on with that. His daughter, Lori, a consultant for manufacturing people, big expertise on tool and die, which seems, you know, so bizarre, but I mean, there she is. And boy,
I didn't realize that. I knew that he had co-developed the Harbor Report with his son, right? I mean, that was...
Well, I think Jim started it, and then his son...
I actually wrote the first two Harbor Reports.
Is that right?
I did, yeah.
Wow.
Jim hired me to do that. And then Lori came in and took that over. Ron was involved all along, and they really took it to, you know, the famous report that it became.
Mm-hmm.
So
He'll be missed.
Yeah, he'll be missed. And what I liked is he was such a cantankerous son of a bitch.
Yeah.
But, you know, underneath that gruff exterior, the guy was really good.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could put up with the gruffness, man, you could learn a ton from that guy.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm going to miss him. Definitely going to miss him. Gary, you been out and about driving anything visiting any places?
No, I mean, this is sort of an interesting thing. You'd mentioned on a show 2 or 3 weeks ago about how there was a report showing the value of good supplier relationships that John Hanke did. And I've just been in Chicago this week at the International
Did you see the 3D printed car, Locomotors?
I saw the 3D printed car.
You're not impressed.
I'm not impressed. And
Okay, go back to what you were talking. I didn't mean to get you off topic.
I found this to be very interesting. So I was talking to a lot of executives at machine tool companies. And the thing that really I found to be somewhat disappointing is, so the company that I work for, Gardner Business Media, does an annual capital spending survey. So they look across all industries in terms of what industries will be spending money in the United States, okay? Automotive is always the biggest spender for capital equipment. Mm-hmm. You could take number two and number three, add them together, and that would be aerospace and medical. Add them together, they're still not out of automotive. And to a person, every executive that I talked to in that industry was more interested in doing work with other organizations rather than automotive because they thought that automotive was too difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about what you were saying about that Hanke report, and man, this is not good for them.
No, it's not. No, it's not at all. And, you know, we were just talking about Lori Harbor. She did a big study last year on tooling costs, or was it earlier this year?
It was earlier this year.
Yeah, on tooling costs and practices. And one of the things that she dug up that floored me is that if you're a tooling supplier to the Detroit 3, GM, Ford, or Chrysler, you don't get paid until job one, even though you develop and deliver tools way before job one. You incur millions of dollars in costs that you might have to eat for years before you get paid.
And that's just with the domestics?
Just with the domestics. It's beyond stupidity.
Yeah, and I talked to Lori last month about this, and you know, and she was saying that if they can get work from other industries, you know, these die makers,
they're gone.
They're going to be more interested in that because, you know, they pay more reliably, more quickly.
Right.
And so here are these guys who have their houses mortgaged and everything else in order to make this tooling and are waiting for that job one day.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the findings that Lori came up with is what you need to do is, you know, maybe you pay in thirds. So right up front, you give them a third. You know, they hit all these, you know, benchmarks and goals and milestones. You give them the next third. And then when the thing's finally delivered, you give them the final third. But don't let them dangle there for a couple of years with millions of dollars.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
That's an interesting thought, because there are every once in a while vehicles that get designed and get pretty far along in the process. You know, there's some level of prototyping. You know, you see the mules out in testing, and then the vehicles don't happen for one reason or another. So that means that, in all likelihood, there's at least some suppliers left holding some pretty serious bags.
Mm-hmm. Listen, at the management briefing seminars, you know, the big conference that we were at earlier this summer, I remember talking with a number of tooling companies, American ones, who were saying, thank God for Honda. Honda believes in having local tool and die suppliers. And they said, when times got tough, it was the Japanese who were keeping us alive, not the Americans, even though we, speaking in their behalf, were American tooling companies.
And speaking of the management briefing seminar, that we talked to Dr. Mark White of Jaguar Land Rover, and the guy who's all about the body engineering, and there was that new Jaguar XE that came out this week.
Yeah.
What do you make of that, Chris?
I think that's pretty fascinating. So the last time that that Jaguar was in this segment was the much maligned X-Type, right, which had the Ford bits underneath it. And this is really, a clean sheet design. It's an aluminum intensive platform and bodywork. And they're going to run in, 4 and 6 cylinders, front and all wheel drive and all of that. And they're going after the 3 Series pretty headlong. And it, from the looks of it, it looks quite attractive. You know, it's familiar looking. It's not too dissimilar to something like the XF. But I've liked the way Jags have driven for quite a while now. And now that they've gotten smart enough to not only, not have just a V8 only lineup, which is what they had for years, I think they could be pretty competitive in the global market. One of the things I'm wondering about is if they can keep the weight down of that car. Even with aluminum, they're not always succeeding in having low curb weights.
If they don't, they're dead, because that's their unique thing that they can bring to the market. If they can come out and be significantly lighter, and the benchmark is no longer the 3 Series. I mean, the Cadillac CTS and ATS.
Well, ATS would be the competitive with the with the 3 Series.
So if they're not under that, why even bother?
Well, I mean, you can say that, and I think it should be that way. But then you look at something like the F-Type, and the F-Type's a heavy car.
It's porky.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to drive, but it's not lighter than a 911. It's not lighter than a Boxster, and it straddles somewhere in between. And that's, you look at that, it's extensive aluminum in the chassis and in the bodywork. And
speaking of porky cars, I just got a chance to drive the new Lexus RC, which is this premium sport coupe that they're coming out with. And I want to say the base car is 3,900 pounds. I think if you get the RCF, which is the 5-liter V8, with all-wheel drive, it's about 3,800 pounds. Now, the good news is it's got gobs of power. I want to say, what was it? Oh, I'm blanking out now.
Well over
467 horsepower, something like that. So the power-to-weight ratio.
So could you tell?
Yeah, when you get out on the track, you can tell. We were up at this private motor club, Monticello, in New York, and it's got most of the track, at least the configuration that we drove, has these grand, big, sweeping turns, which were actually very good for that car. And there were only a couple of points where you had, some real quick chicane-like left-right, and then you could really feel the heft of the car. But, very interesting. This Lexus is, it just screams from a styling standpoint, look at me. It's no longer, we're just, very quiet Lexus.
Oh, I think the whole lineup has gone that way. Yeah,
maybe the ES. Yeah, absolutely.
I think what happened was, they were sick and tired of hearing all that pissing and moaning. Everybody saying, "Oh, they look like appliances. They have no soul. They have no personality."
Yeah,
and
just
like, guys, you shouldn't say that, because they're going to respond. I mean, it's
Well, they've gone to the other end of the spectrum now, where there's enough lines on them for 3 cars.
But one might make the argument that if they didn't do that, then we'd say, they're pussyfooting their way there.
Yeah,
so they're making a bold statement. Now others have to say, okay, how are we going to respond to that? Mm-hmm. So speaking of lightweight and high performance cars, there was another car that was introduced this week, the Mercedes AMG GT car.
Yeah, that looks like a pretty fascinating vehicle. I mean, I've had a lot of time in the SLS AMG, which is kind of its predecessor, but not really. And that's, of course, you know, the Gullwing V8 car
Roadster. But this one's substantially lower priced.
Right. It's lower priced. It's smaller. It's probably going to end up being, you know, around $100,000 or $120,000. So maybe an upper-level 911 competitor. And I think it looks a lot more homogenous. I mean, it looks... I like Gullwing doors. They're a neat party trick, but they didn't do the SLS's look any favors in terms of the proportions. And this car looks really sharp. Hopefully we can get a picture of it up on the screen. I think it's something that'll probably play in a bigger volume segment. We talked about the F-Type. It's interesting. I think when the Jag came out, they mentioned something like, you know, it's been X number of years, maybe 10 or 20 years since... Yeah, look at it. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
X number of years since there's been a new nameplate in this segment, and it might have been 10 or 20 years, and so they were celebrating, and now we've got another one.
And it's light, 3,454 pounds.
Wow.
510 horsepower.
And let's remember that Mercedes is not always terribly gifted in lightness, right? I mean, that's not their stock and trade.
They're not known for that,
no.
Right? But I got to tell you, I think from a styling standpoint, Mercedes is doing terrific work these days.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's those who don't agree, but I like what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. I do, too, especially, you know, it's a look at the styling on that car. While it's still got real presence and it's a wide, low look, it doesn't have a lot of... you know, frippery to it. It doesn't have a lot of design tricks and all that. It's really organic. And, you know, we were just talking about the RC, and that's a really, it's a complexly surfaced car with a lot of interesting details to it, but I don't know if the whole thing hangs together in the right way.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how that car ages, the RC. Mm-hmm. But I think, to Gary's point, you know, this was Lexus's way of saying, oh, so you think we can only do bland?
Right.
Look at this.
Well, and I think you're both right. I mean, it's probably a necessary statement for them for that. And then maybe you'll see, you know, they work some things out, they smooth it out. I remember back when Audi adopted the single-frame grille.
Oh, yeah.
And I always thought that the cars before that were just gorgeous. You know, they were very... very, you know, streamlined and done just so. And then they threw this horse collar grill in the front, and it all just went to hell in a handbasket. But if you look at that over time, they made that statement, and they kind of worked it in, they figured it out. And I suspect the same thing will be true with Lexus.
And the bangle butt. I mean,
yeah.
When, you know, Chris Bangle did that, the BMW.
Yeah, that and maybe we just get used to it, you know, the flame surfacing or whatever it is. And look at what Hyundai did with the Sonata. I just got out of a Sonata this week, too. And the new car is so much more conservative in design than the last car, which was, you know, really pushed the envelope and said, hey, you've got to pay attention.
Well, you know, different horses for different courses kind of a thing. So when Sonata needed to break out, you had to do, or they decided to do, something that was much more dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, boom, instant success. You know, the car's selling like crazy. Okay, now you can be a little... conservative. But I would also add that the last gen Sonata styling was very controversial in Korea.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, the top brass in Korea did not like the look. And Korean customers, by and large, you know, thought it was too flashy.
Right.
So it's a little bit of that as well. I think the, you know, the guys back in Seoul saying, let's tone this down a bit.
Right. But, I mean, if we go back to the MX-5 that we saw the picture of, I mean, that's certainly taking it to a more aggressive level than the previous. As you mentioned, it wasn't so smiley and happy as the earlier ones were. Look at the new Stingray. I mean, that's certainly a very aggressive, very much styled car that, you know, screams look at me in ways that I think that previous generation Corvettes haven't.
Right, and look at the incredible Corvette sales right now. I mean, that car is a bargain in every sense of the word.
Right.
But the styling is something that I think a lot of traditionalists, when they first saw pictures of it, were like, oh, I don't know if that works or not.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that's going to catch on? And the sales show that it has. And I kind of suspect the same thing will happen in a different way for the Miata, because I think there's a lot of people, and we've had feedback from our readers that said, you know what, I've always loved the Miata. I love the way it drives. I like the package size, but I just couldn't drive one because of the reputation that they have. And now I can finally
trick car.
Yeah, the kind of hairdresser car thing. And I've always thought, you know, I own one. I don't really care about that. I love the way the car drives.
Yeah.
But I think if you're hung up on that with this new design, it's much more, you know, it's much more muscular and it's much more aggressive, especially in the front, that I think it'll, you know, entertain a broader audience and probably still not upset too many traditionalists.
Hmm. Hey, cool. We ought to wrap this up. Right. This has been great talking with you guys, and it was great having Russ in here, too.
Yeah, it's great having that car in here.
Well, yeah. You know, I still got to ask Ben, how the hell did they change the color on that thing? That blows my mind.
Well, you know, you could probably power the whole studio if you just set the thing on roller.
you could probably power the whole studio if you just had one of those, transmission coolers or...
Anyway, Chris Pockert, thanks for coming over tonight, man.
Thank you. Always great to be here.
Gary, good
John,
seeing you as always.
Seeing you.
Okay. And we'll catch all of you next week.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
Visit our website, AutoLine.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.